Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilek, and Sujit Mallow, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic, and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 91, being recorded on the 26th of August, 2015, with special guest David Crawford. My name is Sujit DeMello, and on Skype with me, I have Kale Teeter, Evan Basilek, and our special guest. Now, David, before I give you a chance to introduce yourself to our listeners and give them some information about your background, what we normally do on the show here is we try to get our listeners caught up on the latest and greatest happenings in the Azure space. You know how it is every week there's something going on, right? There's something being released, there's some new version, there's some new preview product. And while we find it difficult to keep up with all the enhancements, we try to keep our listeners abreast with as many of them as possible. So we'll just do a quick run through on that, and then we'll get it to some more relevant stuff with your background. Does that sound good?
Sounds great.
Okay, great. Well, so let me just go through some of these updates, and feel free to chime in, David, if you've, any of these feel familiar to you or you've worked in any of this stuff. But the first one that caught my eye was the Cloud Foundry, which I guess it's some sort of a open source PaaS offering. Is that what it is? Is that the best way to describe Cloud Foundry?
That's what it looked like when I was taking a look at it. I was starting to read through it because I had never heard of it before, but that's what it sounds like.
Okay, and so it looks like the Azure Preview second version is out is available now. And if any of our customers who use Cloud Foundry and want to host it in Azure, not on their on premises, they should take a look at it. It's got all the deployment aspects have been taken care of now, where you can deploy it on Azure using the Bosch init commands. So that'll make it a whole lot easier for people to manage their VMs, their Cloud Foundry VMs. Then the next one is, I'm sure all of our listeners know about Mark Rusinovich, and he's put together a nice little, I would say like a blog entry, where he talks about, all his thoughts on, there's all these things about containers and Docker and Windows, what runs on Windows, what runs on Azure, and how you use what. And he is kind of laid it out nicely in a little blog item. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. A related item there, just today I was working with my customer, a financial service customer, and they're interested in some of these container technologies, and apparently the latest version of Windows Server 2016 TP3, Technical Preview 3, has support for containers, Windows containers, not Docker, but Windows containers, which do work with Docker. So that's just a side item there, but we'll put a link to that in the show notes so that our listeners do get some updates on, get some clarity around where this fits within the overall cloud space. David, have you worked any with containers at all?
No, but I've seen that they've been extremely popular and, very, very active development community online. And when looking at something like our Service Fabric, it seems very close in some aspects, this move towards microservices and hyperscalability. That seems to be the way of the future.
Yeah, I actually read that, the paper that, Mark did on that, and I didn't realize that you could now do ASP.NET stuff with this latest, Windows container release.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty neat, because then, you're leveraging the stuff that we've known how to do for, I don't know how many years ASP.NET's been out now, maybe 10, but now you're leveraging these microservices with it without having to do anything different, really.
Yeah, I think the other cool thing with that, Evan, is the vNext stuff for ASP.NET. You can run that in Docker, like on Linux. So there's the core CLR and running some of that stuff actually in Docker on Linux, which is kind of cool.
It actually kind of begs the question to some extent. I was thinking about this the other day. And some of this is something that we at Microsoft are pushing, because obviously we want people to use our stuff. But as we move kind of away from the, you must use, Windows, and you must use, .NET, and you must use our database, to, hey, we'd love it if you use our database, we'd love it if you use our OS, but really we don't really care what you run on Azure. It almost seems like some of these areas are converging, right? You can do CLR in Linux in a Docker container, or you can do ASP.NET in a Windows container, which also can run in Docker.
It is, and that's one of the reasons why I thought Mark's article kind of clarifies some of that. It can get a little confusing when you mix all these things together. It almost it makes you wonder how it all works together. But that's definitely something that we need to. I think we need to have a whole entire show on that. Hopefully we can get somebody who can clarify some of that for us, or maybe we get some hands-on experience there. But yeah, that's something we'll put in the show notes.
The other thing with that is, if people read that, what I thought was really cool about that paper that Mark put up there was about how he talks about virtualization and how we got to where we are. And, how we did this thing like virtual machines, and it was like, well, this is great now because we're not wasting maybe some hardware, right? We could take more advantage of this hardware and densely pack VMs on it. And then it becomes, but why are we loading multiple copies of the OS, and then getting into that whole strategy of how can we pull that piece apart? I thought that was really cool about the article. It was really neat.
Well, yeah, I definitely have to read that. I just kind of skimmed through it, but... some good weekend reading material there. Then just moving on to, we haven't really talked about this Azure government offering that we have, right? This was something that's been around for the last few months. And one of the things with the government is that they have certain very strict standards that have to be met for security or for handling of data and things like that. So there's all these certifications that Azure government service has to pass, they have to pass all these certifications so that additional areas in the government can use them. For example, some of the new things that came out is they support the FedRAMP now supports provisional authority to operate, it's called P-ATO. And some people wonder, why is that important? And there are some divisions that use Azure Active Directory and the multi-factor authentication, and these are now certified for U.S. government. That's really what it is. And by receiving that P-ATO certification, government organizations can use that facility in Azure, in the Azure AD. So that's an important thing there. Then the second one is for the Department of Defense, for them to be able to place non-sensitive data on Azure government applications, that has met this thing called the DISA Level 2 standard. Then there's the HIPAA, which we all know that's kind of more which relate to medical information and the like on Azure. And then finally, there's the IRS sort of certification, which is more tax-related data that can be stored on Azure government. So these are all important certifications, I think, that allow more departments in the government to take advantage of Azure.
One area that's kind of different right now is that we're starting to look at more hybrid scenarios with the Azure government cloud. Because, you would think that some things have to have that certification, but other things don't. For instance, there's all kinds of uses for things like Azure websites and others that they can take advantage that don't need that same security environment, yet still can be used by those government entities. And so we've been working with those government agencies in order to help them construct hybrid scenarios as well in between the government and the commercial side.
So, David, when you're talking about that, are you talking hybrid in this? You're not talking hybrid connectivity that we typically talk about. You're talking where maybe part of the solution's in Azure government, parts in commercial, or when you say hybrid in that context?
Yeah, we were looking for a word to describe running in both of our clouds. But
right.
Yeah, the hybrid that we were talking about here was that there are certain applications that come out that are, you know, perfectly of good use to the government, but they haven't gone through the scrutiny that's required for the government, that being in the government cloud. It
right.
could be that they're ready for it, but, you know, they still have to go through a certain process. And it may be that there's times where they want to take advantage of some of these capabilities that don't really require all the security and the certifications, you know, say like a public website. And
gotcha.
So in those cases where they have those kind of workloads or integration with, say, the commercial entity side, you know, many of the government organizations interface with commercial organizations. So in this case, what we have is a commercial cloud integration with a government cloud backend.
Oh, that's cool.
And,
okay.
Wow. That's a nice stopgap measure until we get full certification on all these things. That's very nice. Okay. So,
take time to dot all the I's.
I agree. Yeah. And we have taken a while to do it, but it's a slow process. I understand that. Just moving on to some of the other announcements that we have here for our listeners that you are interested or using Azure ML, that is now being made available in the Southeast Asia region, which is basically in Singapore. And why that's important, why that's important to have it there is because obviously there's these aspects of data sovereignty where, you know, customers based in Singapore want to have the data locally, so it has to be within a certain geo. So now that they can put all that data and have it processed by Azure ML in that new service in Singapore, and also the latency that they get when they are using the Studio UI integration to be able to craft up all these R language constructs and whatnot, they'll have better response time because it'll be closer to where they are. So that's an update on Azure ML. Have you guys using PowerShell? I know Kale, you're a big PowerShell user. David, do you use PowerShell?
Here and there. There are certain things that we're using PowerShell around integrating with the Graph API.
Mm.
And so during our testing process, we're generating accounts and doing any number of things that help us work with our vendors.
Okay. So it looks like the latest version of the Azure PowerShell 0.9.7 is now available. They've added support for downloading, uploading, and copying appended blobs. We talked about, you know, being able to append blobs last time. It's a new feature, but now there's support in the command line that lets you do that. Also, asynchronous copying, you know, which is nice. They've added that. And then one of my favorites is being able to do the cores management in Azure service. This has been a problem quite, you know, as I'm sure David, as you and Kale are aware, every time we stand up a service in Azure, we had to create these cores entries in there in the config file to be able to allow them to be accessed from other domains. And now that can be done automatically using the commandlet, so it can be put as part of a package and done automatically there.
Yeah, one thing just to comment on the especially the PowerShell commandlets, just to make people aware of it. You know, we put those things out there, and the easiest way to get them is through the web platform installer. So if you have that stuff installed, it's like super easy. It'll find the dependencies if you're installing things. There's not a lot with the Azure PowerShell, but you can also download like the MSIs. You can find those on the internet too. But the one thing I wanted to mention was it's on GitHub. So these things, if you go out there and search on GitHub for Azure PowerShell, you can see it right there, and it's wide open. So if people want to contribute or get involved in this, that stuff's out there in the public. So just wanted to make note of that.
Yeah, right. and throwing in just a little plug for my stuff.
I was about to say that, Evan. Yeah. I know you've written a blog item on this, haven't you?
Yeah, I got tired of keeping mine up to date, so I have a script that'll do it for me, and it checks every day at 2 o'clock. And pulls it down.
Nice.
So,
Yep.
That is the sign of a true programmer, right? Do I want to spend 5 minutes every once in a while, or do I spend 3 days fighting with a script that I did? Just perfect, right?
That's awesome.
Great. Yep, I was just about to say that. I'm glad you did. Okay, so that's PowerShell. And then just moving on to the logic apps. And maybe, David, I think this is something that you're kind of close to. Do you want to talk about that, the loop control that they've added in there?
Well, I think some of the great part about logic apps now is that by having the ability to compose API apps, you really save yourself in that whole, I'll say, redevelop, refactor kind of thing, because now you have this great composability layer that sits on that. So I highly recommend going out to something like the YouTube channel for Azure Logic Apps and also the build presentation on them and get a full deep dive, because they're really powerful, yet you can use the programming model that you're very likely familiar with. The other thing that's really cool about the integration there is the Swagger part. So Swagger, if you're unfamiliar, as a metadata, it's also it also presents your REST API, where you can have it self-documenting, and you can do your tests right there, and it really is great for productivity. That gets rolled up into the cards that are presented for you to compose in the logic apps. And so it's sort of like a natural extension with a composition language that works on top of that.
You're saying that the logic apps will recognize the Swagger metadata? Is that what you just said?
That's right.
Wow. That's new. Was that always there, or is that new?
That's how they work. There's actually a template for the API apps, and then you can essentially roll them up into the logic apps to compose them together. And as you do that, once you get your results or some of the other constructs, like there are some polling constructs. Again, we were talking about all the stuff being out on GitHub. The samples are out on GitHub too, that you can download and do like your own file listener and things like that. But you know, we have hundreds of adapters that allow you from the logic app side. They're called connectors, mm-hmm. and you know, they allow you to be productive right away. You want to pick up a file, you want to do some data enrichment, and then write it to, say, an Azure SQL database. You can do that within a few minutes as opposed to coding something. And if you want to, like, say, maybe pick up an email, important email comes in from customer, and you can read it and then write it to a Yammer group and then start collaborating around the responses and email that you've received. So really powerful, really neat, and the ramp time is kind of short on it.
Yeah, I was just going to say it sounds a lot like BizTalk, but I guess that's where the idea for logic apps came about, right? From the BizTalk server orchestration and things like that.
Yeah, actually, they came up with it at the same time as Azure Resource Management. And they were looking at the composability within our services and said, hey, let's make something even bigger out of this. And so it grew from there.
Great. Yeah, one thing, a little trip down memory lane here, but when I saw Logic Apps the first time I saw it and when I started playing with it, and you know, I went through some of the examples and how this thing could compose data together, kind of like what David was mentioning, like I could take something from Twitter and you know, pipe it through this thing and put it somewhere else. The thing that blew my mind like right away when I first saw it was like, I saw this a while back. So I just looked it up on Wikipedia. We'll put the show in the show notes. I don't know if any of you guys on the podcast remember this, but there was a product called PopFly that Microsoft had back in, like, it says 2007, but I remember when this came out, and it was one of these mashup things. It was
yes,
this tool.
Yes, I used it, actually, for a while. Yeah,
dude, I was all about it. I remember it was a Silverlight client, yes. And you could come in here, and you could hook things together just like this. Obviously, Logic Apps is way more powerful and has a lot more features and those kind of things. But it was when I saw it, the first time I saw it, I thought, I was like, I've seen this before. Like, I've seen something like this, you know.
That is a trip down memory lane, no doubt. But just on the Logic app, so one of the enhancements that they just added on now, a couple of things is they've added some loop control, you know, like do one to loops, I guess you can do now. And also they've added HTTP fire and forget feature. So just to add on to some of the things that you could do in these apps, make it more productive for you. And then, you know, one of the things that people have always struggle, right? If you have an application, especially a line of business application, you obviously want it to be highly available. And you always scratch your head like, you know, okay, what do I have to do to put this to in the cloud, right? To make this work in Azure? Because there's a lot of moving parts when you're talking about not only a line of business app, which has to work with some on-premises thing, but also you want to make it highly available. And so the good thing is that they put together a whole bunch of guidelines and things like that, and what you do you need to do in step by step. And we'll put that in the show notes. Things are very nicely laid out, set of documents that explain exactly what has to be done, you know, all the way from the configuration to the domain controllers to SQL Server configuration to the web servers, you know, creating availability groups and so on and so forth. You know, all the stuff that I'm sure all our listeners are already aware of, but just puts it all together in one place. So we'll, I think they call it an architecture blueprint, but we'll put that all together. We'll put that in the show notes as well. And then DocumentDB. David, done any work with DocumentDB?
I started working with some of the sharding. We introduced a new sharding library, and pretty cool. You know, it takes a lot to figure out how to make your data spread out in a way that's, I'll say, balanced, and a way that'll continue to be performant and essentially just distributed. And so people came up with a bunch of their own sort of hashing algorithms in order to accomplish distributing their data. And we essentially took that and came up with the most common patterns and introduced a new feature to the client that allows you to more easily accomplish that. You can still do your custom sharding, but we provided you all the basic ways that people do it now.
Okay, and this is for the geospatial data, like across multiple geos, or when you say sharding?
It's more, I mean, you could shard by a geography, but it wouldn't be the geography, like, say, the location of the data in that form, as much as you might have a massive number of users that reside either in multiple countries or multiple states. And you want to find a way to distribute them or balance them together, however that makes sense for the logic for your app.
Okay, I see.
Or
what
it
you
could
mean.
Be that you're trying to, that kind.
Okay, so spreading out the data across based on what's in the data. I understand. Okay, so one of the updates that came out in DocumentDB then was more in the handling of geospatial data, which is more like, you know, coordinates and map data and stuff like that. Because that's there's obviously special things that have to be done there if you want to be able to query, for example, what's the distance between this point and that point. Now you can do that in DocumentDB because it understands the geospatial data, and so you could say, you know, what's the closest way to get from say this document information to that document information, and it will figure it for you. So I thought that was pretty cool. That's in the new version of DocumentDB. Some of the libraries you can pull down from GitHub. Okay, let's see. What else have we got there? Well, there's a couple of other links. We'll put them in the show notes. I didn't want to. I think they were kind of there. Anyone? Any of those that you guys want to cover? Cale, Evan.
No, I think that we got a couple other things. Maybe we'll cover it next time, but just wanted to get to David.
Okay. So, David, please, I know you've already provided a lot of input already. It looks like listeners already know you, but give us a little bit of background as to, you know, what you do at Microsoft and what's your relationship to the Azure world.
All right. Well, hi, I'm David Crawford. I'm a solution architect with America's CTO organization. And what we do is our group provides the early guidance around Azure technologies, around mobility with the modern apps. We work with the data platform area, and we spend a lot of time working with, I'll say, the early adopter customers, essentially coming up with the methodologies and approaches for our emerging programs.
Okay, and this CDO organization, how do customers like get connected with them? Is it, I mean, they can't just ask for the CTO, obviously. I mean, how do you guys like hook up with the right customer?
Sure. What happens is we have an organization of architects that are distributed both regionally and by product specialty. And so the regional architects tend to be, say, your East, Central, West, and then you have your specialties, say, public sector, and that breaks down into things like state and local government and so forth.
Okay.
Well, when each one of those architects are working on something, they have the ability to call out to a group that's product specialized, and that comes with our service lines. So I'm part of the application platform service line, and my goal in life is to make you successful with anything Azure, App Dev, you name it. And so basically I get called in through the regions.
Okay, I got it. And I know you mentioned that you're doing some work in mobile services. Is that what you you said? How's that, like, is that something that's very popular that you're seeing in generally speaking in terms of how customers are using Azure?
I'm seeing it become a lot more popular, especially over this last year or two. You know, I've been working with Azure for quite a long time, and you know, the demand for our resources around Azure has just gone up exponentially. So as far as, say, the mobile services specifically, we actually saw a surprising amount of early interest, and you know, it was surprising only because you know, we said, okay, well, you know, how much do people want to learn about the Azure services? And if we've made stuff real easy, well, would they use it? Well, much to our surprise, they do like easy. Go figure. anyway, what's happening is that with our Azure App Services, we've now constructed a very robust environment with Azure websites, mobile services, and logic apps and API apps, so that they now all have some common characteristics and availability and so forth that make utilizing the whole group more efficient, easier to maintain, cost less, and all that fun stuff. So I'd say that we're seeing people, more enterprises, take a look at it. And if you're an enterprise, you know, you might want to authenticate with Azure Active Directory. Well, we even have something called EasyAuth now, where we make it very easy for you to select Azure Active Directory as one of your authentication approaches, and you're off to the races. Literally, it's configuration, drop down, and go.
So David, this is Evan. So help me understand the difference between, say, like an architect, right, in the role that you're in, and, you know, some mm-hmm. of the, you know, customer advisory team folks that we have that go out and work with, you know, key customers or whatnot. I mean, like, are you more involved in some of the conceptual and less in the kind of getting down and dirty and doing the solution? Or, like, you know, help our audience understand the difference between, you know, really what the architect actually does.
Okay.
And not in a bad way, right?
It sounded like,
don't do any work. You know, just
it sounded like Office Space there for a second. What would you say you do
actually
here?
Do.
Yeah, the job of the architect comes in, I'll say, early in a cycle for an engagement. So we help our customers envision what they're trying to accomplish. And, you know, we come in with, hey, I got a business problem. I'm trying to figure out how to do something. How would you do it? And this is what I have to work with. So in that early stage, I help them work through their vision, give them their options. And while I'm doing this, I'm looking at the different workloads and characteristics that need to be employed throughout that. And it really depends on which type of application they want to build or system that they want to build, who I bring with me in order to accomplish that. For instance, if we're producing something like a modern app with a back end like say mobile services, we have one of the best UX teams in the world. That's my opinion, of course. And you know, these folks, I mean, some of them have like I'm not sure what the, like the top awards are. I think it was like Emmys or some of the others related to various industries, and they've literally brought that into that expertise within our team. And some of them focus on interaction design, you know, the flows of how your application works, and you know, others are into producing digital imagery. And what we do is we take what they're envisioning from that side, and we identify all the coding and applications that come into that, and then we give estimates on, you know, what we think it'll take to accomplish. Now, some of these things can be quite complex, and so in order to make sure that the vision that our customers wanted to, basically the vision that we agreed on gets implemented in code, then we become billable as part of the project and become a delivery resource. And so we'll work to make sure that the application is composed. We'll, in many cases, do coding, or in other cases, you know, we might help organize the team and make sure that the application starts getting composed in the way that it was envisioned. Make sense?
Yeah. So you guys are actually there for potentially the, you know, the entire process, all the way from envisioning to actually implementing, and, you know, maybe not all the way to shipping, but, you know, something pretty close to the, hey, this is the real thing at the end.
Oh yeah, I'll be there at the end. I'll be there for the closeout. I'll be there for, you know, basically off to the transition to what our ITSM group would take on from there.
Right.
So in other words, if you need support services and governance and management, you know, we'll help you wherever you need to go with it.
Cool. Now, David, generally speaking, though, are our customers ready to do some of this actual implementation work themselves, or do they feel like very nervous taking on an Azure project and want more Microsoft involvement? What are you seeing out there?
Well, I do see a lot of customers that want to reduce their risk with cloud projects by having experienced architects and delivery resources working with that. So they will bring us in to help out with that. But there are also plenty of partners out there that, you know, we work hand in hand with out in the field in order to help customers implement their solutions. Now, there are some customers that I work with that are just doing all kinds of wicked cool stuff. You know, one of them in particular that we have case studies with out there, they're doing a lot of work around equipment maintenance and, you know, trying to leverage things like machine learning to do predictive analysis for failures, you know, and predictive maintenance effectively. So, you know, some of those leading edge manufacturing assisted companies are doing some really great stuff in order to, you know, do these activities to boost the bottom line on these types of orgs.
So, okay, so it sounds like the companies are coming up with real cool ideas to implement, but they often need Microsoft's help to actually implement them.
I've seen our input in one way or another, even if it's just one of us providing some guidance, yeah.
Now, earlier when we were talking before the show, you mentioned something about Azure B2C. I think that's a relatively new thing. Could you give our listeners a little bit of a background into what Azure B2C is and how they might leverage it?
Well, what Azure B2C is the evolution of our access control service. And, you know, right now we're still at some early phase, so I'm gonna leave the product group to message a lot of the stuff about that evolution of access control services.
Okay, so this is something that's not yet fleshed out, and I don't think we've announced any release date yet, right, on this stuff?
No, there's no dates being announced just yet. But I would say definitely keep your eye out. There's some really cool stuff. Watch the Azure Active Directory blogs, and that'll be probably the best place to keep your eye out for when that comes around.
Well, yeah, Kale and Evan, what else would you guys like to find out from David?
Yeah, I mean, I guess one of my questions, David, I mean, what's kind of maybe one of the neatest things, without going into too many details that you can't share, but I mean, what's kind of some of the really neat things you've gotten to do as an architect and go help design? I mean, anything you can share with us that way?
I'm trying to think of how I can describe some of the solutions other than I'll say the integration work with the cloud and some of the capabilities that we've brought with some of our customers has been really neat. I know with a major city that I was working with, it was really fun working with one of their SaaS providers, which was a project management company that's very specific to the construction industry. Mm-hmm. And so what we did is we worked with that SaaS provider and got them wired up into our gallery of Azure Active Directory SaaS providers so that essentially our government customers could just add them and then, you know, they'd be wired up with federated authentication out to that SaaS provider.
That's part of the AAD premium offering, right, that you're talking about, right?
Actually, I don't think that it requires premium to just add a SaaS provider. I think anybody can add one of those applications.
Okay.
Now,
okay.
But yeah, you can effectively go to the gallery and say, like, you know, add this particular company, and then it's wired up, and the users that are in that directory can now authenticate out. There's some background.
I was going to say, that's the stuff that we do, which I can't remember if we talked about it in one of our sessions here or another user group that I was in, but where we do the managing the users and or synchronization behind the scenes so that the customers don't have to do that stuff directly, right?
Mm-hmm. It's,
yeah, okay. That's cool. Yeah, so you really get to run the spectrum then, just depending on whatever it is that particular customer wants. I mean, it's kind of bring whatever they need.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're also doing... Okay.
No, go ahead, David.
I was saying that we're also working through the initiatives like App Portals. And App Portals is a Windows modern application that allows you to surface information that you'd be interested in. Like, you know, a lot of people use it to integrate with... you know, KPIs or their CRM system, you know, to
right.
surface all the stuff that they need quickly.
Was it create a dashboard
so,
of some sort or something like that?
Yeah. A lot of people are interested in, like, you know, finding out all the stuff that they need within their role. And, you know, bring up an app and suddenly I see, like, boom, this is sold. These things need some action. You know, these are the stats for where I need to focus and go from there. But yeah, a portal and a modern app effectively.
That's cool.
Now, David, I sorry, Sajid, I just had one question. David,
sure,
uh, I don't know if you get involved in this as much because you do a lot of work with big enterprises and large companies, but do you see anything? Because one of the big hot buzz things now is IoT and these little devices like Raspberry Pi 2 and all these little things that we can build and kind of attach, and Azure has a lot of vectors and a lot of ways we can kind of plug those things together. I was just wondering if you're seeing any of that out there, if you're seeing people that are interested in that, even in the enterprise.
Oh, yeah. That's some of the neater stuff, and I'll say it's really cool, but a lot of these things we can't talk about because this is really the height of innovation by a lot of big companies, and they're finding new ways to use devices and telemetry for business advantage. I mean, I can give like a basic one, which is like, let's just say predictive maintenance, or you know, trying to determine if there are faults somewhere. We did a presentation at the Global Energy Forum where we showed basically a simulated oil line, and we collected that type of data, you know, like flow rate, drops in flow rates, things that would indicate a failure. And to demonstrate this overall flow, we went through and we used Arduino boards and some local telemetry data that it was sort of simulated for what we were taking off of these devices, but we would flow them up into event hubs, and through the event hubs we used Azure Stream Analytics, and then would write them out into a couple locations. One of them was an Azure SQL database. And what we did is we used Azure websites with SignalR to present those, I'll say, values and changes in real time. So wow. It was
That's
pretty cool.
That yeah. is cool.
I mean, you're looking at a map and stuff's blinking, and you see like the values coming off representing each one of the nodes of the pipe. Yeah, it's cool.
Now, you, I'm glad you mentioned all those pieces and components, because I was going to ask you how you put it together. But isn't this whole IoT suite is supposed to kind of make it easier to do all these scenarios now?
That it is. A lot of the details for that, again, we're sort of at that early phase. So I'll say details around what that will actually accomplish are still... I'll say undisclosed.
Correct. But the expectation is that it takes a lot of what you just talked about and kind of because it's a very common scenario, what you just described.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, see, the thing where I find all this real interesting is there's this industry that's doing all this currently, and, you know, they're rather mature, you know, your manufacturing and such like that. What I find interesting are all the scenarios that I can help corporations accomplish in ways that, you know, they just never thought before. And, you know, it ranges from simple things like some people just want to manage their parking lots. And so from an IoT perspective, there are now devices out there where such as like cameras that do object recognition. And you can look at a parking lot and see if your parking lot's full. You can even like automate your, I'll say, rules around parking. Like nobody's allowed to park in front of the fire hydrant, and it'll notify you if somebody parks in front of the fire hydrant for, you know, your security group to deal with. I think that there are so many places that people can imagine what to do next. And it's going to be a really, really exciting time over these next years, taking telemetry from devices and bringing that data to the cloud and then doing something interesting with it. I think we've only begun to touch what's possible. Definitely. The other side, 3D printing. 3D printing right now is just at its infancy, but... You know, think about all the things you can do with enclosures and these devices. So now when you look at like AllJoin and these protocols that allow devices to be more easily composed, and what we're producing what we have now with Windows 10 and that capability built in, it's gonna enable you to compose devices together in some really interesting ways. I'm just excited as all get out to see what happens when people are trying to solve their problems using these things.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, I think that's the stuff that the power of the crowd is going to drive, right? Because there's just so many different things people are going to come up with that, you know, you could never come up with all of them on your own, right? It's going to take all these different people thinking of stuff, and it's going to just drive incredibly cool things are going to come.
Yeah, I mean, look, your home users right now, what are they doing? They're starting to move into home automation, which is one area, and that can range from home security. You know, a lot of people have had, leaks with plumbing and things where you could have sensors that would notify you and prevent a larger amount of damage. There are people that just want to do it for fun, which is like, water their lawn. Then you can look at others that are trying to be more efficient with their electric usage, monitoring that. Now you take that on to robotics, and you know, people do it for entertainment, or they may do it for, say, you know, a sensor that the dog walks up near the screen door or the sliding door, and you have a little servo open the door for them and then shut it. So, and now we can take that and, you know, supersize it up and say, okay, well, what does this look like in a larger world? And that larger world might be efficiencies for businesses. And we've worked with partners like Iconix that help companies with our technology and working with them as well to look at full buildings and what efficiencies and maintenance need to happen on that scale. So really amazing times, really cool stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Agreed. Well, thanks so much for all that input and advice, David. Really appreciate it. I'm sure our listeners appreciated that too. Anything else for David before we wrap up? We've already been on this for quite a long time and realized.
I gotta admit, I appreciate you coming, David. I'm a little jealous. You get to touch almost everything. I tend to get hyper focused based on, you know, what I do. So, but it's really neat to see the range of things that any one project will use. So, thank you for coming on.
Yeah, David. Thanks. Yeah, it was awesome, man. You brought a lot to this. This is awesome.
All right.
It was great to be here. Thank you.
All right, guys. Then we'll call it a show. And again, Evan and Kale, thank you for all your input as well. We'll see everybody next week.
Sounds good. See you, folks.
Thanks, guys.
Sounds good.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle, at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.